It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services reported 3,279 new cases of COVID-19 in the state. We'll talk to a public health expert to learn more about why the number of cases is going up and what you can do to stay safe as the weather gets colder. First, between now and next month's general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and on the morning show. You'll be able to find all of these interviews at WPR.org/politics. Now we'll talk to the candidates running for Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District that covers Madison and the surrounding region in south central Wisconsin. Democrat Mark Pocan is the incumbent in the race. We'll talk to him in just a bit. Facing him is Republican Peter Thiren. He is a math instructor at Madison College. Peter Thiren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, sir.
Let's dive right into some of the big issues in the race. Health care and the Affordable Care Act, a big Supreme Court case coming up after Election Day. If the Affordable Care Act were overturned in its entirety, what would you like to see to replace it at the federal level?
Let's first note that, yes, health care is a hard problem, but it's not as hard as bringing peace to the Middle East. We have a lot of experience in terms of allowing the private sector to make certain health care very, very affordable. The examples would be cosmetic surgery and LASIK eye surgery. LASIK eye surgery, for example, was roughly $1,000 per eye in the 1990s. It's now less than $500 per eye. So think about any other health procedure you know of whose price has been cut in half. So it certainly is something that the private sector has been able to contain costs and lower costs. But I would say that one thing, so it is a problem. It is a hard problem, but it is a solvable problem. I think that the one thing we need to recognize is that the government does not have all the answers. Obamacare, which was something that the Democrats put together by themselves, they did not want any input from Republicans. They passed it with no Republican votes. It was a partisan bill from the start. It was also arguably an unconstitutional bill from the start, which is part of the reason that they're worried now about adverse court cases. If they had worked in a bipartisan manner to produce a bill which was acceptable to both Republicans and Democrats, then they wouldn't be worried about this. I think both sides coming together on this, realizing that the government does not have all the answers and that the private sector has a lot bigger role to play, we can, in fact, move forward.
What kind of specific change, then, would you like to see that you think Republicans and Democrats could agree on?
We've seen movement in terms of the president's executive order on prescription drugs, where by executive order he was able to cut the costs to patients for insulin and other prescription drugs by essentially cutting out middlemen. I think that that's something that both Republicans and Democrats should be able to look at, okay, what's the legislative framework around that? Because obviously it is much better to do things legislatively rather than do things with a pen and phone.
Staying on a health-related issue, as we're hearing in the news, Wisconsin saw a record number of positive COVID-19 tests today and sadly a record number of deaths. How would you work to curb the spread of COVID in your district and around the country?
If I'm remembering right, the total number of cases which was reported was 155,000. But what I'm seeing on the Wisconsin Health Services website, Department of Health Services website, is that we've had only 1,508 deaths in Wisconsin. So if you do the math on that, that says that we have less than 1% of the cases resulting in death. That is not a fearsome disease. Remember that President Trump was diagnosed with COVID-19 on a Thursday, hospitalized the next day, cured by the following Sunday, discharged by Monday. And he's promised to make the drugs that he got available to all Americans. someone who, Donald Trump is 74 years old. He is not a spring chicken by his own admission. He'd probably say he's a great summer chicken. But it's not a fearsome disease. It's nowhere near the bubonic plague in terms of its lethality. It is something that we can manage and get through.
President Trump has pretty good health care compared to what a lot of people have. But we're at, 215,000 deaths and counting in just 1 year? No, it's not the bubonic plague, but it's a pretty serious disease.
Well, okay, so you just said 215,000 deaths. That's in the United States.
Correct.
Okay. Let's remember that in the United States, the average weekly death toll is 51,000. So right now we're in, week 40? So if you take the total number of deaths in the U.S., the number of COVID deaths is, again, a very small percentage. And also note, as far as something being counted as a COVID death, we've seen that it's sometimes the case that even the person wasn't even tested. It was added because, well, there was COVID-19 in a family member, but that the particular person who died had never been tested, but it still ended up on the death certificate.
Because in that case, there would be clinical description of the disease. That was especially early in the pandemic.
People have looked at those death certificates, have seen that that nationwide, only 10 to 15% of those death certificates list only COVID-19. Most of those death certificates list something else like heart disease, cancer, stroke, so other things that could very well have contributed or perhaps even killed that particular individual. I would also point out that one other problem we're having with the lockdowns is that again, the 51,000 deaths per week, each one of them is a tragedy. People are not being able to go to funerals. They're not getting the closure of a week. They're not being able to comfort each other. The claim that it's a super spreader event, we just had a huge rally in Los Angeles for the Los Angeles Lakers winning the basketball tournament. No criticism in the media for lack of social distancing and lack of masks. And yet in the news report that I just heard coming onto the show, it was specifically mentioned about a rally for Vice President Pence and the mention of social distancing and masks. So the media has been very inconsistent as to whether a peaceful protest or a political rally is a spreading event or is not a spreading event. So I think that the media has a lot to bear in terms of why people fear COVID-19, whereas they didn't fear H1N1, which Obama's chief of staff at the time admitted that they did everything wrong.
Talking to Peter Theron, running as a Republican in Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, part of our series of interviews with candidates. Turning away from health, what are your thoughts on rebuilding the economy in the year to come if you're elected to Congress?
Okay, first of all, I'd like to mention that I am the law and order candidate. It is very important to note, as we saw in the riots on State Street in Kenosha and Wauwatosa, that destruction is quick, easy, and exhilarating. But construction, which is the work of civilization, is slow, it is hard, and it is boring. But after you've upset the apple cart, where do you go eat lunch? So that boring work of construction is something that I think needs to be celebrated more often. That exhilaration of destruction needs to be not only criticized, it needs to be condemned. So I specifically asked my opponent to condemn the violence associated with Antifa and Black Lives Matter. And he said, well, there are elements within that are causing this. Well, then the question is, who's funding those elements? Given the protest is often followed by riots, we had the riot kitchen from Seattle that was arrested in Kenosha, who funded their cross-country trip, who funded the gasoline that they were purchasing. Then in Louisville, we have a U-Haul, which parks on the protest route. The protesters knew to approach this U-Haul. They start pulling out protest signs and riot helmets, riot shields, and other riot paraphernalia. Again, who's funding, who's organizing? I think the violence needs to be condemned, and those organizing that violence need to be identified, and if they have broken laws, arrested and punished.
Just a minute or so left. Any thoughts on rebuilding the economy?
Again, the economy was going gangbusters in January. We suffered a lockdown hit. We are rebounding greatly. I think if we continue on our path of hope in terms of reducing regulation and encouraging people to build for the future with that alternative, that is the path forward that Donald Trump and that I would support going forward in Congress.
Peter Theron, thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Peter Theron running in the November 3rd general election. He's running as a Republican to represent Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes South Central Wisconsin. He faces Democratic incumbent Mark Pocan. He's a math instructor at Madison College, and we'll talk to the incumbent Mark Pocan next. Between now and the November general election, WPR has invited candidates running in contested races for congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You can find all these interviews and learn more about the candidates and races at WPR.org/politics. More to come on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. WPR has invited candidates running in contested races for Congress in Wisconsin to join us for interviews here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. We'll do these between now and the November 3rd general election. Find them all at WPR.org/politics. Now we talk to another candidate running for Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which represents South Central Wisconsin. Earlier we talked to Peter Theron. He's a Republican running to represent the district. Facing him, Democrat Mark Pocan, who currently holds the seat. He's running for a fifth term. Representative Pocan, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with the Affordable Care Act, a big Supreme Court case on this. Could change it in part or remove the whole thing. If it were removed and you are in Congress again, what would you do to start trying to replace it?
Well, I think it's imperative that we keep the provisions of the Affordable Care Act available for the public. I think one of the things that often gets ignored that for the last 3 3/4 years, the Republicans have tried to get rid of it, but they've had no alternative. And, what the Affordable Care Act means is not just access for 20 million people, but it means if you have a pre-existing condition, you can get health insurance even with a private insurer, something that many, many people benefit from that didn't exist before. Adult children stay on their parents' policies until they're 26, and women pay the same as men for coverage and many, many other provisions. So I think, when Joe Biden's elected president, one of the things that we'll be doing is strengthening the Affordable Care Act, hopefully adding a public option, maybe looking at adding buy-in to Medicare, lowering it to age 60. I would like to go farther, but those are a couple things that I think we can do to make sure more people have access to health insurance.
There have been concerns, and this has hit some people in kind of middle income categories harder than others, that for selected groups of Americans, their costs, their premiums have gone up at the same rate as they did before the Affordable Care Act. It didn't really help them. What would you say to someone who says, yeah, I personally haven't benefited from it?
Yeah, so that's a separate issue, right? Many people have. I mean, even if you had a pre-existing condition, which 100 million people have, you have to be able to be offered health insurance. That's a huge provision of the Affordable Care Act. But for people who say they still have increasing costs, that's another issue we've got to get a hold of. We have prescription drug prices where we pay 10 or 20 times what people are paying for the same drug in other countries. We have other provisions of health care that are way too expensive and we have to address. So I think you can do both. You can address the ever-increasing costs on the medical front, but you can also continue to provide access to people to have health care.
Staying on healthcare-related issues, COVID-19, we're seeing record numbers in Wisconsin today when it comes to positive tests. and to deaths. What would you like to see in your new term? If we're still dealing with this, what would you like to see change in the way we approach this disease?
Well, I think everyone knows we're still going to be dealing with this, or at least most everyone knows that. I think the real challenges we have, one, in Wisconsin, as you mentioned, we just had record number of cases, over 3,200, and a record number of deaths. We have to get people to change behaviors. That means wearing a mask, socially distancing, don't have parties and getting together with crowds, especially indoors. We need to be smarter. We have a few weeks to turn this around before we get into the flu season. And if we don't, we could have these numbers ever increasing into the winter. And that's from conversations I've had directly with Dr. Fauci. So one, we've just got to be smarter, period, about how we're addressing this. But two, nationally, you know, I also think that we have some positive light at the end of the tunnel on the vaccine front. Dr. Fauci thinks by the end of the year, we will have a vaccine. There's five or six right now that are in phase three, double-blind placebo tests, 30 to 60,000 people being in those tests right now. And if that happens, he thinks we'll have tens of millions of doses in the first quarter and hundreds of millions of doses in the second quarter. So I think there's some light at the end of the tunnel, but that, you know, sounds good, but doesn't help someone right now who's unemployed at no fault of their own, or a small business owner who's lost demand at no fault of their own. We still have more to do, and that's why in Congress we passed the HEROES Act. We've really done it twice now, waiting for the Senate Republicans to do something, waiting for the president to do something, and I think that's one of the main things we've got to get done is additional relief for unemployed, for small business owners, for our frontline workers, for our state and local governments that are providing our testing and contact tracing.
Talking to Representative Mark Pocan, incumbent Democrat in the race for Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District seat. We heard from his challenger, Peter Theron, Republican, just a few moments ago. Now, we've seen since the death of George Floyd, protests around the country, conflict between communities and police. Peter Theron was wondering, he was challenging you, in effect, to condemn violence that he saw accompanying a lot of these protests and some of the riots that followed. What would you say to that?
Well, he's been challenging me to say somehow that Black Lives Matter is responsible and they're not. So unfortunately, I can't comply with a request that's not accurate or true. But certainly no one, wants violence, and we condemn all violence that happens in any of these situations. But to try to target it to something that would make the president happy is not something that I'm up to do. I'm going to try to do what's right. And, you know, all too often, a lot of these have been outside agitators. I was down in Kenosha, I think a week or so after what happened. And, the majority of arrests were not people from Kenosha in what happened. So, I think what we really need to do is address the policing issues. I think we can reimagine how we do policing. I think we can do what we did in Congress, pass a bill that would start changing how policing is done, so that we recognize there is some inherent racism in many police officers, and we've got to address that. So that means we have to ban chokeholds. We have to start a database of officers that do break the law. And if we do some things that we passed in that bill, I think that would get us far. Also, I introduced legislation to have uniform training for police officers. The only thing that's really uniform in most communities is you have to have a high school degree. But from there, the training can vary greatly. If we require truck drivers to pass a single test and have a single set of knowledge, I think that would be good for police officers. And that way everyone would know what to expect when you're having an interaction with law enforcement. It's good for law enforcement. It's good for any resident of a community. So, I think there's a number of things we can still do, but we have to admit that there is inherent racism in this country, that we have more we have to accomplish on that front. And once we do that, and I think reimagine policing, we can have a much better community that makes everyone get treated equally. And I don't think we really have that right now.
Turning to the economy, no secret, we took a big hit in this country from the COVID-19 pandemic. What do you think still needs to be done to help rebuild from that?
Yeah, unfortunately, the way the president has mishandled this, we've paid a heavy price, not just in the 215,000 lives and the millions of people who've been infected with COVID-19, but also the economy. There's a large number of people who are unemployed at no fault of their own. There's a large number of small businesses that are really hurting because of a lack of demand at no fault of their own. Restaurants, bars, people in the meeting industry, tourism. We hear some of these stories. 20% of small businesses have closed this year alone because of COVID. So we've got to do more there. I think we also need to have a major infrastructure package that we can invest in our roads and bridges, in our schools, broadband, our water delivery systems, our energy grids, and put people back to work who've been impacted by COVID-19. At the same time, repair a crumbling infrastructure that we need to in this country. There's a lot we can do, and I think with the right leadership, with Joe Biden as president, we can certainly get those things done.
In our last minute, the things you just listed there sound expensive. We've already added a lot to our deficit, even before COVID-19, more so with the big CARES Act. Can we afford to do the things you're talking about?
Yes. First, we have to do it right now because of the situation, and government is in the best position to do it. But second, talking to people like Robert Reich and other economists, once you get the economy going, you will grow the tax revenues and help to reduce that deficit or debt that's created. But right now, the only entity that can really do what needs to happen is government, and we do have more responsibility to do something. So whether it be a COVID bill like we passed in the House or an infrastructure bill, those are a couple of things that will pay off as investments in the long run.
Representative Pocan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Mark Pocan. He's a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District that includes South Central Wisconsin, much of it. He is running for a fifth term in the November 3rd general election. He faces Republican challenger Peter Thiren. We heard from him just a few moments ago. Between now and the November general election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You can find all of those interviews and learn more about the candidates and races online at WPR.org/politics. The State Department of Health Services recorded 3,279 new cases of COVID-19 in Wisconsin. We now collectively have had more than 155,000 positive cases in the state. 34 people died from the virus in the last 24 hours, bringing the total number of deaths to 1,508. Today's positive test count and the death toll are both records in Wisconsin. As the summer came to a close, Wisconsin saw a notable increase in the number of positive tests, and the number of cases and hospitalizations has been growing since then. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions or concerns do you have about this big jump of COVID-19 here in the state? What do you want to know about the virus, the potential vaccine, potential treatments in the future? What are you doing to try to stay safe? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's also one of the editors of the Dear Pandemic online forum. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, what is behind, do you think, these growing numbers leading up to this record, unfortunate record day here in Wisconsin when it comes to COVID-19?
Yeah, it's not the kind of records we want to be breaking here in Wisconsin or anywhere, actually. I think this is the buildup. This is the accumulation of cases over time, over the past few months, over this summer. You know, the Safer at Home order came to an end abruptly in May. And while we had done a lot to flatten the curve, I don't think we were, you know, ready to lift that Safer at Home order in terms of having the other infrastructure pieces in place around testing and around contact tracing that really needed to be ready to replace everybody staying home as our main mechanism for containing the virus. And then over the past few months, we've all, you know, enjoyed sort of some semblance of normalcy, returning to social interactions or activities, perhaps not exactly as we had been doing before, hopefully while wearing masks and social distancing. But you know, we saw a surge in cases in younger individuals over the summer months. And I have, there's unfortunately a lag where it's really hard to keep, you know, younger people separate from older or more vulnerable individuals in the population. So once we see cases surge in one group, it will carry over and spill over into older individuals who are vulnerable to complications. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing here, unfortunately. And, you know, for us in public health and as epidemiologists, it's, you know, it's upsetting to know that this facility we built back in March that we hoped we'd never have to use is actually, you know, having to be utilized now as an alternative care space for people who are hospitalized with COVID-19.
Yeah, can you talk about the stress this is putting on hospitals now? We managed to beat that scenario early in this thing. It seemed like we flattened the curve, like you said, for a while there. What are we seeing in hospitals now?
Yeah, I mean, I think surges in certain regions of Wisconsin, namely the Fox Valley, the Northeast, and the Southeast region, where the growth in hospitalizations and ICU use was surging last week. So the decision was made to open that alternative care facility to try to allow patients that only, you know, are lower acuity, they don't need as intensive of care, to be moved to those facilities to free up space in some of these other areas of the state where we are needing to hospitalize people and they do need, you know, a ICU space.
I wanted to ask about a claim that's come up on and off throughout the pandemic from members of the public, some in the political world, the claim that the COVID death toll is overstated. The arguments are either, well, look, death certificates list COVID and something else on them, or some of the cases, you know, they weren't actually tested for COVID. They were just based on clinical descriptions. Is there a problem with an overstatement of deaths because of COVID?
You know, there's not. We've seen, and one way we can look at this, because it, you know, it gets around this idea of how do we diagnose a COVID death versus a death that would have occurred anyway, is to look at excess deaths, excess mortality that's occurring this time of year compared to this time last year. And what we see is, you know, I think estimates of upwards of 20% more deaths. And that's just looking at all over deaths, right? And so we know that people are dying of COVID-19, that people with chronic conditions, you know, who get COVID-19 are dying sooner than they would have otherwise.
We are talking about the latest news in COVID numbers here in Wisconsin, talking to an epidemiologist about what's going on and what could help turn things around in the future. Amanda Simonek with us from UW-Milwaukee and editor of the Dear Pandemic Online Forum. You could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Amy is with us in Arvina. Amy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So back in April, a dear friend who's a scientist at the U, has 20 years in virology, was warning that we should prepare through the winter. And since then, I've been stunned by how politicians on either side, like one side actually, they're pretending like it doesn't exist or that it's no big deal because someone else is dying, not them. And the other side just isn't taking a strong enough stance. This is a life or death situation. There's a lot of unknowns. And I personally have experienced a loved one in my immediate family being in the hospital with severe pneumonia, and nobody could spend time with him. We couldn't visit him, and he wasn't able to talk on the phone. And so not only was that traumatizing for us and him, it was also extra burden on our healthcare workers. And so in addition to that, we've got, where I live near Sauk County, the school district is just completely upside down because our health department in Sauk County, the director just left because he wouldn't falsify information. It is utter chaos.
Amy, thanks a lot for the call. Amanda, Amy's saying that at a lot of levels, she is not seeing this thing being taken seriously or appropriate measures taken.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we really need to follow the science, and that's the bottom line. The science tells us, you know, that this is a severe respiratory illness, that it spreads easily, that the ways that we can stop it are through social distancing and mask use. You know, something that is particular about this infection is that starting about 2 days before you develop symptoms yourself, you can transmit this infection to others. That makes it really different from seasonal influenza, for example. With seasonal influenza, you're most likely to transmit to people the day you develop symptoms, the day after. And by then, you're already kind of in bed, recuperating and isolating yourself, you know, from people outside your household. With this infection, you know, we have to basically assume that we may be infected if we've been out in the public and that we need to protect other people from this infection. And so, you know, the more that we can embrace that idea that it's up to us to wear masks, to limit our social interactions, the better we'll be at containing this outbreak.
Let's bring on another caller. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hello.
Since the majority of deaths, especially here in the United States, are older people, 60 and up, that's more than 90% of the deaths are the people 60 and up. Those, a lot of those people have already retired or are near retirement. Couldn't we just quarantine and protect the people at risk? Because the rest of us got to keep working, shutting down an entire country for basically what is a severe seasonal flu. I don't care what the your guest there says, the numbers say different. The seasonal flu is 0.1%. COVID is 0.03%.
Do you want to address that, comparing this to a seasonal flu? This has killed way more people than any seasonal flu in, what, a century?
Yes, but I would like to address the issue of sort of protecting vulnerable individuals and letting the economy otherwise go back to normal or letting people interact, you know, on a normal level. And this is really a misunderstanding of how this infection will spread in the population. So, you know, we, number one, it's, you know, very difficult. It would be very difficult to truly isolate people who are vulnerable. And those are not just people who are 60 and older. It would be other people that have chronic conditions, you know, people that are immune compromised, that are younger. So it wouldn't realistically only be individuals. And we also don't want to socially isolate a portion of our population. But if you think about assisted living centers and other places, they're largely staffed by younger individuals, right? So it's not realistic to expect or this to work, right? To sort of shield part of the population and let this infection run rampant in the other part of the population in order to have the economy reboot. And really, that's a false dichotomy. I think we can find a compromise where, you know, we open sectors of the economy smartly, and we support those sectors that need sort of financial support in order to function during this pandemic period, you know, but sort of sequestering off a portion of the population isn't going to be a realistic tactic for controlling this infection. Another reason why is that even people who don't die from this infection have long-term complications in many cases. So there's a whole sector of people who are getting COVID-19 that are called long haulers that for whatever reason, you know, months go by and they don't recover. They're experiencing symptoms like chronic fatigue, you know, trouble breathing, muscle weakness, brain fog, you know. So there's sort of this persistent post-COVID viral syndrome that is lasting for months for people, which can cause a lot of, you know, disability essentially and inability to re-enter the workforce. So this idea that we could realistically put, you know, some portion of the population back into work and sequester the vulnerable individuals is really just not a tenable solution.
We're talking to Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. She's one of the editors of the Dear Pandemic online forum, looking at the latest COVID-19 numbers and news. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the latest COVID news in Wisconsin with Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. John is with us in Green Bay. John, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to say, I think we need to just be truthful with what's going on. I'm a driver. I don't want to say where I work, but everywhere I go, north of Green Bay, nobody at all is wearing a mask. Not one person. That's all I got to say.
John, thanks. John's sharing his observational data there. Amanda, there are places at least where he says people are not wearing masks at all. What needs to happen to spread the message further?
Well, we do have a statewide mask mandate, you know, and the hope is that that enables businesses and other places that where the public can be indoors to wear masks. The more people that wear masks, they protect each other, right? So the mask will keep the droplets that you might expel while you're talking, while you're, sneezing, while you're coughing, out in public behind your mask and with you. And so will the other person's mask serve that purpose. I think as we head into the winter months, these practices around social distancing and mask use are going to be extremely important because in indoor spaces where there may not be as good of ventilation, that's really going to be key. And we need to, as the temperature cools and we have to move indoors, we really are going to have to embrace mask use in those indoor spaces to help prevent transmission of COVID.
Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us now in Glendale. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I think one of the issues that we have in this country about people not really buying in to doing what the CDC recommends around masks as well as social distancing, it's been building up for several decades that we have vested interest beating the drum that individual rights supersede concerns for the community. So I think for quite some time now, we've had a seedbed that really has emboldened people to put their own self-interest ahead of concerns for how we're affecting each other with deadly consequences.
Thanks for the call. Can you talk about, a little more on public health messaging, Amanda, to overcome what Jerry's talking about?
Yeah, you know, I think that all of us want to get back to a more normal life, you know, and the challenge is that when we have high levels of transmission of COVID in the community, it increases the risk for anything that we might want to do, right? And so the way that we can most quickly get back to more normalcy and, you know, being able to socialize and be enjoying restaurants and movie theaters and businesses is to make a collective effort to stop the spread of transmission of COVID-19. And the sooner, you know, the more more we rally around this idea and the more we work now to flatten this curve, this surge of cases that's been occurring, you know, then we can return to some normalcy. And so I hope that people will embrace, you know, the public health messaging and the mechanisms that have been discussed for the past 7 months around keeping your social circle small and consistent, wearing masks, keeping, you know, space between you and other individuals, and trying to avoid poorly ventilated indoor spaces, because that these are the settings in which, you know, a lot of transmission happens. And so, I think the call to the state of Wisconsin is to come together to, you know, rally around what we know works to stop the transmission of this virus.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to epidemiology professor Amanda Simonek from UW-Milwaukee, looking at the latest COVID-19 news and taking your calls and questions. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering, for the people that do take appropriate precautions for COVID-19, wearing masks and sanitizing or washing their hands, what is the risk for succumbing to the annual influenza?
That's a great question. So, you know, many of the measures that are being recommended in terms of social distancing and mask use and hand washing are going to help mitigate the spread of influenza virus as well, because that is also a respiratory virus that's passed through coughing and sneezing and droplets. So we hope that through those measures being taken, we do see a reduced burden of influenza this season. I will say that one of the best things that anyone can do right now, in addition to, you know, maintaining space, masks, well-ventilated space, restricting your social circles and the time that you spend in gatherings is to get a flu shot. You know, the more we can reduce the coexisting burden of influenza and COVID-19 as we head into winter, the better. These are two viruses that have very similar symptoms. So if you develop influenza and you go to the doctor, they're almost certainly going to have to test you for both influenza and COVID to rule out COVID-19 and determine the best course of treatment, and also so that we can notify your contacts that, you know, they were exposed to someone with COVID-19. And so that means the more flu we have circulating, the more testing, you know, strain we're going to have on our systems that are available for testing for COVID-19. There's also a fair number of people who do become hospitalized because of influenza. Both older individuals tend to be vulnerable to influenza as well as very young children. And so, you know, as we are already experiencing, you know, increased surges in use of hospitals across the state and the need to open an alternative care facility, the last thing we want to do is add influenza cases of, you know, that need to be hospitalized to that population.
Time for one more caller. Let's bring on Kimberly in Fox Lake. Kimberly, hi.
Hi. So where I live, like, nobody wears masks, and my boyfriend's working up in Green Bay, and he is one person on a job site of 1,000 wearing a mask. What is our current trajectory if people just blatantly don't wear a mask and don't social distance?
Yeah, it's unfortunately, you know, right now, because cases are surging, we should expect, and I think that's part of the anticipation in opening the alternative care site or lifting it off the ground, is because there is this lag, right, between when people become a case and then when they need to be hospitalized. And so until we can see a decline in cases, we should expect an increase in those that need to be hospitalized. And so I give your boyfriend credit that he wears a mask in an environment where it's maybe not encouraged or supported. And hopefully he sets a good example for others. And he, you know, through wearing that mask and through maintaining distance from others, he's protecting others from himself. So thanks to him for that.
Thanks for calling in, Kimberly. And Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you, Rob.
We've been talking to Amanda Simonek, Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's one of the editors of the Dear Pandemic Online Forum. She joined us today to talk about the latest COVID-19 news in Wisconsin. Not good news, record numbers in both the number of positive cases and deaths in the state, according to the state health department today. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics, including Supreme Court confirmation hearings and still more back and forth on pandemic stimulus. As political rhetoric heats up with concerns about violence, a guest says there's a lot that the media, political leaders, and the public can do to help calm things down. And it's apple season in Wisconsin, and Apple expert takes us on a tour of some great varieties that may be off the beaten path and can add a lot to our baking and our snacking. Let us know your favorite apple. Email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.